Hi and welcome to Matrix Moments. This is Saloni and this episode is an audio recording from a recent Clubhouse session that Tarun Davda, Managing Director at Matrix Partners India, did with Priya Rajan, MD at Silicon Valley Bank, as well as Anand Chandrasekharan, who is Executive VP at Five9. Anand was formerly Director, Messenger Platform at Facebook and prior to that, CPO at Snapdeal. In this episode, they cover the latest trends emerging in India tech, Matrix's investment strategy through and post-COVID, IPO and M&A trends, among other topics. Tune in.
Tarun, thank you for, one, taking time today, but also being patient with us as we're kind of rescheduling and, you know, bringing it back up today.
My pleasure, and thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to doing this as well, so excited about this chat.
Great. I know we're right at time, so maybe we can just get started. For the folks who are new to this room, thank you again for joining us. This is a series that Anand and I host as a part of the India-US Venture Ecosystem Club called Behind the Scenes. And we have featured several of the top-tier investors and founders who are active in the India-US cross-border ecosystem. And we have done this for since October, November of last year. And we started doing this once a month, and we received quite a bit of requests and interest in doing this more often. So we started doing this once in two weeks. With that said, we did pause for a few months, as I said earlier, because of obviously the pandemic, and wanted to focus on the right things. And now things are getting back. We felt this is now time for us to kick back and bring the series back, and obviously, you know, what best way to kick it off with, like, Matrix obviously was an active investor in the cross-border ecosystem. And Tarun, again, thank you again for taking time today for doing this. With that said, maybe we'll just dive right in. Tarun, maybe you can start off with a quick intro about yourself, and we can also talk about a little bit about Matrix India, and we can go from there.
Sure. Thank you again, Priya and Anand. Thank you for having me on this. Just for a quick introduction for those who don't know me, I run a firm called Matrix Partners India. It's an early stage VC focused on broadly seed to Series B investments in internet and sort of mobile ecosystem in India. Been with Matrix now 9 years, so seen enough cycles, and honestly think we're at the most exciting time in the Indian venture ecosystem as we speak, with so many IPOs coming. Before that, been on the operating side. I ran two startups. The first one was a company called Big Rock, which was actually incubated within DirectEye, and DirectEye wasn't well known back then, but obviously everyone knows Bhavin and DirectEye now, with all the success they've had. That was acquired by a European listed firm called Endurance. And then after that, I tried to do something a little bit more edgy, so set up a dating site in India. This was, again, way back in 2010 or 11. And I think Sasha will remember me pitching to him. But way ahead of its time, way before real identity on the internet was a thing, way before online payments was a thing. So clearly ahead of its time, didn't really work out. Saw a lot of traction, but couldn't monetize, and eventually we had to sort of fold into Match.com. So that's been a little bit of my background. At Matrix, I focus broadly on, three or four sectors. The ones that I'm most excited about right now are social and gaming, and I'll talk about some of the investments we've made there. I spend a lot of time on commerce, and within commerce, specifically social commerce, and we'll talk about DealShare and a few other investments we've made there. And I look at mobility, and obviously Ola is well known, but there's a bunch of other younger companies that I work with in that space as well. So those are the three sort of core verticals that I spend time on.
Awesome. You've been keeping those exciting things that you've been doing as a secret. I didn't even have that as a question, but Anand, I'm sure we have to ask some questions there as we go through this. Maybe I know you touched a little bit upon Matrix. Maybe you can, if I can kind of double click a bit more from a broader Matrix India standpoint. What is your investment strategy, and what it, like in general, but also how has it been through and post COVID?
Yeah, so Priya, VC firms are fairly boring creatures, and the less they change, the better it is. But at the surface, nothing has changed, but I'll talk about, you know, two or three interesting sort of themes that we're following now. So we've always been founder backers. I don't think that'll change. Our biggest successes have been in backing extraordinary founders very early, even if we don't really understand the market or don't really understand what they're building, because, you know, essentially we're backing the player, right? And so it's less about the race for us. I know there's a lot of investors out there who believe in backing the race and not the horse. For us, it's very clearly we back the horse. We're looking for, you know, founders who truly inspire us, truly teach us new things every time we spend time with them. You know, obviously all the other sort of intrinsics around grit and persistence and all that aside, but essentially that's our bread and butter. We continue to do that every day, and that hasn't changed through COVID. Have there been some sectors we're just kind of tactically spending more time on post-COVID? Absolutely. You know, the obvious ones being edtech and gaming and some of those, but I think those things are kind of overdone now. The new themes that I'm excited about, there's a lot happening in the creator economy space, and I'm spending a lot of time there personally now. I think there's a lot of themes which are unique to India. So if you look at, you know, a lot of the V1 of internet in India has been basically things that were already done in the US or China, mm-hmm. right? And so if you see food tech and ride hailing and e-commerce and broader horizontals, a lot of those themes were basically borrowed from the US and China, and then, you know, in some ways Indianized. I think we're starting to see more bottoms-up Indian innovations. And I think that's a broader theme that we've been sort of chasing. Within that, a bunch of B2B themes, especially in sort of, you know, B2B marketplaces, moving all sorts of boring things like steels and raw materials and, you know, seafood and a bunch of other things that, you know, we think are just solving unique to India problems. Stuff like just devotion, right? We recently committed to something in the devotion space. And I think those are things that are so unique to India. And what's exciting about that is there's no predisposed, hey, this is the way it should be built. Right. And so I think that's something that I really like spending time on, because it kind of keeps all of us intellectually motivated. And then the third thing that I'm trying to spend time on is, you know, everybody's brought, like, we keep talking about this California, you know, Indians, which are all online, all transacting, 50, 60, 70 million internet users, which is broadly 10, 15 million households at best, right? And the question we've been asking ourselves is, hey, how do you get the next 50 million households, which is the next 200-300 million sort of internet users, to transact online? And Anand is also an angel in this company called DealShare. And I think that was our thesis to invest behind DealShare 2 years ago, 3 years ago when we first invested, which is, hey, you know, the likes of BigBasket and Grofers and Amazon Pantry, they're serving the 10, 15 million households really well, but they haven't been able to penetrate the next, you know, 50 million households in terms of their sort of, you know, requirement of ordering staples online mm-hmm. and ordering sort of FMCG online. And so I think that's a broader theme we're chasing, which is next, you know, 50 million households. And, you know, how do we, because I don't think it's about simply, you know, extending that customer segment. I think you need to reimagine supply chains from scratch. You need to reimagine customer acquisition from scratch. You need to reimagine, you know, your entire, you know, org structure, because unit economics are very different for you know, that segment versus existing segments. So mm-hmm. I think that's the theme that we've been, these are some of the themes I think we're spending time on. I'll tell you the big change that has happened for Matrix as a firm. And if you go back and just look at the companies in IPO in today, right? Zomato, Dippy, first-time founder. You look at Bhavesh from Ola, first-time founder. You look at Swiggy, and you look at all the companies that are sort of, you know, well-known names today. I think the first generation of internet entrepreneurs were basically the young, daring, sort of fresh graduate archetype. And that's great. And I think those guys will continue to create some of the largest outcomes as they have been in US and China as well. But what separates US and China, or what separated till today US and China from India, was we didn't have this cohort of repeat entrepreneurs, right? And so if you see some of the investments we've done in our latest fund, whether it's a Jitain, who's now running Jupiter, whether it's Amit Lakotia, who is now running Park Plus and earlier was, you know, part of, you know, Make My Trip and Tokopedia and PTM. Jitain was obviously Citrus Pay. Whether it's Medda, who runs DealShare, who was earlier Metro Cash and Carry. whether it's Sandeep and Anandya from Stanza, who would actually, you know, help student housing business in Europe scale. So I think we're seeing this archetype of sort of repeat, and they may or may not have been entrepreneurs in the true sense before this. Some of them were executives in sort of successful companies, but I think that archetype is emerging. And honestly, it's a very different experience working with them. We've doubled down. I would say, you know, maybe 40-50% of the bets we've made in Fund 3, which is our latest fund, have been this repeat archetype, right? And when I talk to my US colleagues and, you know, China colleagues, a lot of them would share these stories with us, saying, hey, we backed this person in Fund 1. In Fund 2, his sort of, you know, CXO started up, we backed him or her. Then the same entrepreneur, you know, went and started a, you know, second company, and we backed them again. And I think that part was just missing from the Indian ecosystem. And I think we're seeing so much of that today, where, you know, just like the likes of Alibaba and Baidu and Tencent just, you know, basically spurned the next generation of entrepreneurs. We're seeing, you know, that happen in India very, very rapidly. And I think that's an ecosystem we're just staying on top of.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is so well said, Tarun. And thank you for doing this. You know, I feel like most of our conversations are just as friends, and, you know, it's so great that you're being transparent about, you know, what you're going through as Matrix with all the folks in the room. So really, really appreciate you doing that. You know, one thing I wanted to talk to you about is, can you dig in a little bit more on, you know, what companies like DealSquare and OiRickshaw, which is also, I think, like built for the next 50 to 100 million people, etc., are doing. I remember, like, when we met in Mumbai, you told me about this oil brand and the soap brand that DealSquare has created, because, you know, Medha, as you mentioned, comes from a grocery background. He understands private labels. So what was happening is, in Jaipur, like, people were buying DealSquare's private brand, even though for years, like, you know, very popular brands from Hindustan Lever and ITC and other companies had been, you know, in vogue. Can you talk? So two thoughts on that. One, can you talk a little bit about the preferences of the next 50 to 100 million consumers in India? Like, you know, if I thought that someone in Delhi or Bangalore would, like, give up on, like, a well-known brand like a Surf or a Rin or Britannia or whatever, and go to the next no-name brand, like, you know, we'd all laugh, right? But that's happening in, you know, so many cities in India, and companies like DealSquare are pioneering it. Can you talk a little bit both about that change in entrepreneurs going after the next 50, 100 million users, and also the boldness of the founders in, like, doing that so early in their journey as a startup?
Absolutely. Great question, Anand. And you know, we're together in both OiRickshaw and DealSquare. So let me maybe just I'll spend a quick minute or two on each company. I think it's, you've picked the theme right? Both of these guys in some ways are going after the next 100 million users. And like I mentioned, that's a theme we've been going after. So I'll start with DealSquare. I think what really struck me about DealSquare was, one is just the obviously it's a very, very large market. It's you know, several hundred billions, but nobody's been able to really crack it, right? And Kirana is still king when it comes to, you know, 95% of how India, you know, shops grocery. And a lot of people look at DealSquare and say, hey, that's the Pindao Dao of India. I actually, and me and the founders think of it very differently. We're looking at this much more as a, hey, if DMart were to be built on mobile today, what would that look like? Or if a Costco were to be built on mobile today, what would that look like? Right? And that's, I think that's the thesis, and that's where we started from. And I think some of the elements of that sort of thesis are, one is obviously differentiated, you know, consumer segment that they're going after. Second is, you know, the price point. Like today, you know, the people on this call, mostly when they order groceries, they're buying, you know, a basket of 1,500 rupees, 2,000 rupees. That basket will, you know, last them maybe, you know, a couple of weeks. And that's essentially their shopping behavior, right? And that's the price point at which economics for some of these other companies work. The next 100 million, they don't have that kind of cash flow, right? And so they're looking for something saying, hey, I don't mind ordering more frequently, but I'm looking for something that I can, you know, buy for, you know, maybe 300, 400 rupees. And maybe I'll order once a week, I'll order once in 2 weeks. Twice a week. But I need someone who can deliver to me consistently and sustainably at that price point. the third thing about DealShare that is unique is there is a focus on local brands. So most people don't know this, right? Most of the large brands we consume, I mean, many of them don't manufacture themselves. There's a very large contract manufacturing ecosystem in the country. And so all the big brands that we consume typically outsource manufacturing to some small local manufacturer, right? Now, the challenge is that these local manufacturers have the know-how, but they don't have distribution. They don't have sort of, you know, brand building capability. And so I think the value proposition that a DealShare gives them is, hey, you're selling this product to, you know, FMCG company X for 100 rupees. They're marking that up to, you know, 200 rupees and selling it to the consumer. What if I were to give you, you know, 110 rupees? So I'm still, you're still making more than what you were making by you know, manufacturing exclusively for that company. You already have the know-how. What if you were to manufacture this, put your own private label on it, and DealShare will give you sort of, you know, local distribution to begin with, but over time, national distribution. And it's been amazing. You know, we started with working with like people making, you know, local brands in oil and atta and, you know, ghee and bunch of other sort of, you know, day-to-day staples. And these, you know, manufacturers have grown like 10x, 50x, 100x after distributing on the DealShare platform. Essentially, like I said, they have the know-how. They're happy to scale operations. They just didn't have a way to distribute it today. And so I think DealShare solves that. And the reason why DealShare is able to do that is because we don't carry 50, 100,000 SKUs. We focus on, you know, 800 to 1,000 SKUs, which are sort of the fast-moving SKUs for a given micro-market. And the consumer isn't loyal to a brand. These are value-conscious buyers. So if, as long as you're able to deliver value to them at that price point, they are basically putting their trust on DealShare, saying, hey, DealShare would have done the vetting to make sure that I'm getting a equally good, if not better quality product, but at a significantly lower price point. Right. And so I think that's basically what we liked about DealShare and, you know, bunch of other things, obviously, but just at a high level, you know, that's the thesis we backed. And because we carry only 800 to 1,000 brands at any point in time or SKUs at any point in time, essentially our entire supply chain is significantly simplified to basically, you know, serving only those 800 to 1,000 SKUs. Right. So that's OilXL is very, very unique. If you look at, you know, the price point at which some of the you know, earlier version of mobility companies, Uber, Ola, you know, a bunch of others operate at, those are generally operating at, you know, 15 to 20 rupees per kilometer, right? Now, if you see the top, you know, 10 cities in the country, there's about, you know, 300-500 million daily commutes that happen in these cities. Okay, if you just take the population of the top 10 cities in India. Uber and Ola today collectively do about 5-7 million rides. It's 1% of the market. Right now, the question we asked ourselves was, hey, okay, so what's happening with the remaining 99%? And obviously, a lot of it is, you know, private rides on sort of own two-wheelers and stuff like that. But there is a large population that travels on shared rickshaws, you know, auto rickshaws, buses, metros, and obviously metro, you know, kilometers being constructed every single day in this country is at an all-time high. And the question we asked ourselves is, listen, that metro rider, they're not going to get off the metro station. They've paid like 10, 15 rupees for that metro ride. They're not going to, you know, get out, fire up and, you know, a cab hailing app and then say, hey, let me pay 100 rupees now to travel the last mile. They're looking for a very unique solution, which is extremely easy to, you know, frictionless to travel that first mile and last mile. And it has to be extremely cost effective, right? They're not going to, like I said, they'll pay 10, 15, maybe 20 rupees at most for that last mile commute. But, you know, we don't have the density of sort of the metro network like a New York or a Chicago has, where every block there's a, you know, sort of metro station, right? And in India, it's not going to be built that way. It's going to be very different. And so somebody needs to solve for the last mile, first mile commute, and somebody needs to be able to do it in a predictable manner and a highly economical manner, given the customer segment. And so I think what we liked about OA was they had kind of reimagined that entire sort of shared e-rickshaw sort of system, brought it online and allowed a user to seamlessly book that and, you know, move that into a subscription service.
And Tarun, one thing just to get you to talk about that, I think when you first talked to me about OA and like I met, Mohit and team, they were not doing this entire battery charging stack, right? So they pretty much invented and built that entire stack in the over COVID, right?
Yes. So that's been, you know, that's been actually one of the examples of, you know, companies actually thinking out of the box and focusing significantly more on the customer during times of COVID. And I've always maintained, all of us had heard the saying, crisis brings clarity. And I think we've seen that in several companies in our portfolio in the last 12 months. So again, just for this audience, I've already spoken about what OA does. But the question we asked ourselves is, listen, who's the most important stakeholder in this entire sort of e-rickshaw ecosystem? And the answer is very clearly the e-rickshaw driver. Now, e-rickshaw drivers' earnings were significantly down because of COVID, because fewer people were commuting. And we said, hey, what's the way in which we can completely do a 360-degree surround of that driver? A, it will serve as a long-term moat for the company, but it'll also help increase driver earnings. And we said, listen, my rickshaws are sitting idle. So firstly, can I add delivery to it? And because it's electric and because the form factor is such that it can hold higher loads than a two-wheeler, but requires significantly lower loads than a tempo that needs a minimum volume for it to be a profitable sort of delivery, e-rickshaw is in that sweet spot where it's got the benefits of a electric kind of price point. And it's got a form factor where I can, have smaller loads being sent much more frequently, right? And so we added delivery as a sort of second business line within e-rickshaw. And then the third question we asked ourselves is, hey, today the e-rickshaw driver basically needs to, just have 2-3 hours of downtime, which they were using to basically recharge their batteries. And we said, listen, what if we were to provide a swapping sort of system where they don't need to have the downtime anymore? And for the ones who are willing to work hard, that's an additional income, because the e-rickshaw has a natural limit into how many kilometers they can travel a day. And so if this e-rickshaw driver is doing both rides and delivery, they're going to run out of that, charge, by 4 p.m., 5 p.m. in the day. But for those who want to work an additional 3 hours and take home and, extra 5,000 rupees a month, we need to provide them this service. Now, the beauty is the moment you surround this e-rickshaw driver with a swapping service and a delivery service and a, ride service, essentially they're hooked to your platform, right? Because they're dependent on you to get their batteries charged, and they're dependent on you for business. And so I think it's a very intelligent thing they've done. It's still early days and a lot of the stuff needs to play out. Mm-hmm. But that's an example of, going deeper into your customer and figuring out what else can I solve to sort of strengthen my affinity with this customer.
There's so many questions. I mean, they're fascinating to hear kind of that journey and how obviously there's so much of maturity in the market that actually shows as well. And folks, I know several of you have raised your hands. So we're going to try to get through as many questions as we can, but we'll try to leave a little bit of room to get some of your questions answered. So Tarun, I know you mentioned this a bit, with Zomato, obviously the IPO coming up. There's been a lot of, just taking kind of a step back, there's been a lot of activity around obviously M&A, consolidations and IPO talks. What is the market sentiment in India for those two? And how do you see that impact on the broader India's ecosystem in the next several years?
It's a very big deal, Priya. I was talking to an LP last night, and they've been patient for better part of the last 15 years, right? And at every point in the last 15 years, I think all of us VCs have always said, hey, IPOs are 3 to 5 years away, right? And that 3 to 5 years became 15 years, but I think it's finally here. And that 3 to 5 became, 2 to 4, and then, 2 to 3, and finally it's happening. So it's a big, big deal. While the system has seen some very large exits in the, with Flipkart and with Oyo, the reality is LPs still saw those as a one-off, right? And they were like, hey, okay, this is great, but is this sustainable and is this repeatable? Can I get to a point like I've reached in the US and China markets, where every year as I'm committing more capital to these funds, there is some liquidity that I'm seeing as well, right? Because that's when the cycle essentially completes. And so I think the strongest signal of a sustainable ecosystem is when there's enough companies that get to IPO scale, right? Because those companies will eventually go on to become larger companies. They will acquire more companies. More entrepreneurs will come out from those companies over time, and so on and so forth. And so I think it's a very, very big deal. I think a lot of LPs have been waiting for this moment. They finally see this as India's moment has arrived. And I think, we've already seen enough proof points of in the last 12 months what's happened in the ecosystem with so much capital coming in. where, because they're seeing the numbers, they're seeing the issue with India has not been lack of IPOs, right? The issue with India has always been lack of depth of market. IPOs was only a symptom of the problem. The problem was the market wasn't deep enough. We didn't have companies which were generating, you know, 100 million plus in revenue, growing 60-80% year on year with reasonably strong unit economics. And unless you don't get to that scale, public markets are very punishing. I mean, A, you can't list in certain, you know, exchanges, but even if you were to list, I mean, there was really no demand. And I think what we're seeing today is because there are these sort of massive consumer brands that are well known, that have reached, you know, IPO scale, are finally listing. I think it's a very, very big moment, and it's a much bigger deal than people think it is.
Yep, really exciting to see those trends coming out. Anand, you had a question?
Yeah, I was actually, Tarun, if you can talk a little bit about the impact. I mean, the Zomato is obviously the one of the most beloved and one of the first out of the starting gate, but there's certainly a pipeline of companies that are ready to go public, right? Like both very large ones as well as some of the upcoming companies that are just like hitting that 100 million plus revenue run rate. Can you talk a little bit about what this does to M&A, for instance, and additional IPOs that happen? And also, like, given some of the funding that's happening, you know, all this the flurry of activity that's going on, is there also, like, you know, there was this thread around how hard it is to, like, hire in India right now if you're hiring, like, engineers and product managers. I'm sure it's true across the board. Can you talk a little bit about, like, the downstream impact of that on things like hiring, things like, you know, the quality of founders leaving and starting, M&A and stuff like that, just the impact of this on the broader India ecosystem?
Yeah. I think great question, Anand. I will say maybe two or three things, right? Just the way I think this is a big moment for LPs and obviously, you know, VC funds and so on. I think it's a very big moment for employees and specifically early employees at these companies, right? Not just obviously, I mean, finally the dream of ESOPs and the promise of ESOPs is coming real. You know, people have seen the journey of 0 to 1, 1 to 10, and 10 to 100. Right. And like I said at the early part of the call, I think one of the things that was missing in India is there were very, very few people, I mean, almost non-existent, who had seen a real 1 to 10 and a 10 to 100 journey. Right. And so I think what just imagine right now, people who have been part of Zomato for the last, you know, 5, 7, 8, 10 years, whatever, however long the company's been in existence. Imagine the people who are going to come out from those ecosystems and say, hey, you know what? I've seen this playbook. I know how to hire. I know how to build teams. I know how to sort of build, you know, strong customer value propositions. I know what it takes to engage with investors and sort of, you know, share my vision and my dreams, right? And so I think, and they've been through tough times. I mean, and those tough times have obviously hardened them. They know it's not been easy. I mean, every single company that looks like a success today, whether it's a Zomato, whether it's an Ola, whether it's, you know, Policybazaar, at different points, they all have stared at, like, you know, low single digit months of runway, right? It seems like all these companies have always been, like, you know, meant for success. That's never been true. I don't remember, and you guys, you know, some of the people on this call who I distinctly remember this thread. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, there was a lot of negativity overall about overvalued companies and how, you know, investors are crazy for giving these kind of valuations to these companies, and these companies are burning money, you know, hand over fist and stuff like that. And there was a poll, I can't remember who ran it, but there was a poll and it said, of these unicorns, which one is likely to go out of business first, right? And it's ironic, and that time the only unicorns in the ecosystem were Flipkart, Ola, Zomato, and maybe a couple of more. And Zomato was the one that got the highest votes. Right. And I think somebody should take that tweet thread and put it up back up when we're seeing that same company, you know, listed at anywhere between 8 to 10 billion. Right. And I think,
yeah,
and that's what I'm saying, right? Like the confidence that gives you when you've been battle hardened, and those same people are now going to come back and say, hey, you know, it's okay. You know, I can, it's much harder than it looks from the outside to build a company, but they've been through those sort of tough moments, and they will have the grit and the persistence that is required to tide through similar difficult times when they're running their own companies. So I think not as much spoken about sort of phenomenon, but very important. I think second is ESOPs. Yeah, I mean, we all have been part of company and, you know, hiring discussions where in India, the discussion first starts with, hey, here is what I was getting in my last company. I am expecting a 20% raise. So my discussion with you should start at that 20% raise and over and above that. And okay, all this done, now let's talk about ESOP. Right? Whereas in the Valley in China, people look at ESOP as a real tool, not just for retention, but they're looking to, you know, test long-term commitment and long-term alignment of vision between the founders and early employees. Right? And these are people who are really taking a bet on the startup. They understand that early stage startups can't pay as much capital, sort of salaries. Whereas in India, it was, you know, salary plus plus and ESOP. Hopefully, what's going to happen now is a lot of these people will value the ESOP, and it's not just a piece of paper that you're signing. And I know salaries in right. India are crazy right now, and everyone is creeping about them, and it's extremely hard to find talent. But we are seeing signs of, you know, people who have seen the value of ESOPs come and say, hey, you know what, it's okay. I don't mind taking a 30% pay cut from where I am today, because I believe in your company. I believe that your stock is going to have incredible value over the years. And so I think some version of that hopefully will play out in India as well, just the way we've seen in US and China.
Absolutely.
I don't know if I answered all the parts of your question, Anand, but just, you know, those were the two things that struck me.
This is great, Tarun. Actually, one specific thing I was curious about, and I'll just ask you to talk about both aspects of this, right? So a few years ago, like 2016 or so, 2015, 2016, there was sort of this meme that, hey, some of the use cases for key categories in India will be more like the China growth than like the US growth, right? Particularly in fintech, particularly in transportation, use of technology by second tier towns, et cetera, et cetera. How do you see that trend now? Like, do you feel like there's now, we're in that stage where companies that grew in China are like happening in India? Or do you feel like there's a start of like the 3.0, where there's like India specific, like third generation companies that have already started, or we're still in the second generation? And then like the second part of that is, we're also seeing some of the good parts and the bad parts of, like, you know, tech growing really fast and becoming big, right? Like with the Ant IPO and like some of the executive changes in China. And we're starting to see some of the big tech versus government regulatory back and forths, and, you know, like it's almost like a boxing round with like 12 rounds, right? Like one round the companies win, one round the regulatory folks win. Can you talk about both of those trends, you know, like, you know, the way China went and the way India is going, Tarun?
Yeah, so, you know, it's been fascinating to watch what's happening with the China ecosystem. I'm not an expert on China, but with that disclaimer, I can tell you that, you know, I read this quote, what the government giveth, the government taketh away, right? And so that's some version of that is playing out, unfortunately, over there. I think, at least when I look at, you know, regulation in India, my sense is, you know, the government has done a fantastic job. You know, whether you look at sort of payment systems with UPI and Aadhaar and, you know, Jan Dhan and a bunch of other things, or you just look at, you know, the way, you know, different sectors, government is, I mean, I don't think there's been a deterrent. In fact, there's active conversations happening even on the IPO and the listing side, right? Or talking about new listings, talking about sort of why, you know, startups are different, why tech companies, you know, you need to have a different set of sort of rules for allowing these tech companies to make losses for some more time. The kind of value it's creating for the country, making sure that these companies can be domiciled in India and can list in India. And the government is actively participating and listening, right? So in my mind, I think the government is doing a fantastic job. Obviously, you know, things take longer than what they would otherwise take. But I'd rather have that than, you know, have this artificial sort of, hand over me where, you know, we don't know at what time somebody will just come and take away everything that they've given us, right? So I think it's, you know, different contexts and different sort of things. Just zooming out, if I take a look at China, right, and this is a part that I think a lot of us, it's always good to zoom out and look at what's happening in China and see how that could be sort of instructive for India. So China has created about $3 trillion of market cap on the internet in the last 10 years. $3 trillion, okay? Of that, obviously, $1 trillion has been between Alibaba and Tencent. If you look at basically, you know, what are the factors that contributed towards this, right? Well, basically, China's GDP in those last 10 years grew from $3,000 to $3,500 GDP per capita to $10,000 GDP per capita. The internet users went from, you know, 100 million to 700, 800 million. their internet usage like 10x'd over the same time frame, right? Now, if I just take a look at what's happened in India in the last 5 years, thanks to Jio, our internet users have gone from, you know, 100 million to 700 million. Our internet usage is not 10x'd, it's 100x'd. India as a country consumes the highest amount of, you know, gigabytes per month per user. I think we're at like some 16 gigabytes per user per month now, right? Which is just incredible. Like, I don't think there's any other country in the world that consumes the kind of data that Indians consume. And if you look at our GDP per capita, it's growing. Now, it's not growing as fast as China grew, but if I put all those together and I say, hey, India's today $2,000 to $2,500 GDP per capita, it's going to get to maybe $4,000 to $5,000 GDP per capita in the next, you know, 10 years. I think I can make a case that India internet will create close to $1 trillion, if not more, of internet market cap over the next, you know, 10 years. Maybe it's 15 years, I don't know, but somewhere in that range. Now, out of the trillion, will some part of it go towards the large global sort of, you know, the Amazons and the Ubers and, you know, whatever else will do? Absolutely. But is there, you know, $600-$800 billion of that market cap that will be created by sort of homegrown entrepreneurs? Absolutely. And we're just scratching the surface. If you take the total market cap of all the, you know, companies in all the sort of tech companies in India today, it's still sub 100 billion, right? Like, you add Flipkart, that's, you know, 37, 38 billion. And then everybody else put together is probably another 60, 70, 80 billion, right? And so it's sub 100. Like, there's still another close to $700-$800 billion of market cap that will get created. And so I think it is. I don't think there's been a better time to be an investor, to be a founder, to be an early employee at any of these companies. There is a lot of value that is going to get created. And I honestly, that's what keeps us going, right? That's what, you know, it's not easy building companies. It's not being an investor in these early stage startups. 7 times out of 10, you're wrong in sort of the bets you make, and, you know, your investments lose money. But what keeps us going and what keeps us, you know, sort of chugging along is, hey, you know what? I can be part of building some of these companies, right? In some shape or fashion, either as a founder or as an employee or as an investor. And I think that is the most exciting part.
Yeah, it's so amazing to hear, again, the optimism, but the numbers are speaking to it. Again, it's coming across from across the stages and sectors. So one of the things I wanted to kind of deep dive a little bit, I know we're over time, but Tarun, you know, let us know if there's a hard stop.
I think we can keep going for another 10, 15 minutes.
No, that's great. I know there's like a couple of folks who have been raising their hands and being patient. So one last question before we kind of pull some of the folks up. You've been a strong supporter of, obviously, global SaaS companies, you and like Matrix, India as a whole. You know, obviously, some of the companies that maybe Anand and you have done together, Pesto, obviously, and you have Moengage, SuperOps, Rocket Lane, all of them are proud to say that clients of SVB. You know, SaaS has grown from India, significantly evolved in the last few years. It's a no-brainer that we are seeing it in the trends and in interest that global investors are having in India as well. What are some of the metrics and that you, at, like, the, when you look at a deal that makes you go like, okay, that's the deal I want to be in? What kind of stands out to you and what matters?
Yeah, so I think a great question. And, you know, we didn't talk too much about SaaS, but again, that's a sector that I do spend some time on. I think it's fascinating to see what, you know, Freshworks will hopefully list sometime later this year or early next year. There's BrowserStack, there's a bunch of other large companies that are there in the overall SaaS ecosystem. My sense is, you know, if you see version one of sort of software development, it was all services, right? And obviously India created incredible value between Infosys and Wipro and TCS and several others. I think version two of Indian SaaS, at least, was, or Indian software, was basically Freshworks of the world and several others in that same time, Zoho and, you know, a bunch of others, where basically we were looking at, you know, global products and saying, hey, can I build these products? Can I use sort of, you know, the Zoho playbook, so to speak, and use that to create a equally good product but at cheaper prices, right? And serve sort of mid-market and, you know, SME customers. And obviously, over time, many of those companies have gone up market and gone enterprise and, you know, done those things. But I think what we're seeing, and I think what excites me about some of the younger bets that we've made, is A, obviously the same experienced founder sort of phenomenon that I spoke of earlier. Both Rocket Lane and SuperOps are sort of ex-Freshworks experienced employees, and before that, they had sold their first companies to Freshworks. So A is that repeat founder kind of thing that is playing out, which is very exciting. But also, they are building, in my mind, they aren't looking at a global product and saying, hey, let me build a cheaper knockoff of this. They're taking basically bold bets and saying, can I build a world-class product? And maybe better than an offering which exists in the market today, and use that to sort of acquire and serve global customers, right? They already understand how, as a country, we already have great product management depth. We already understand inside sales and inbound marketing and outbound and all of those good things that, that we've learned through some of these other companies. But these are daring entrepreneurs that are now saying, hey, let me build something that, I'm not just building, V2 of a company that has already done well and I'm serving a different customer segment. I'm actually going after very large, big, new, exciting problems. And in many cases, we're seeing sort of almost co-development, right? Like there are competing companies in the US and in the Valley that are building something, and there are Indian companies going after the exact same problem at the exact same time. And so it's going to be fascinating to see how we're able to compete on that sort of global stage.
That's right. That's awesome. Thank you for the insights. Anand, you had a last question, and I'll pull up some people up.
Tarun, I think, the other thing that would be good to talk to for this audience is, I know Matrix has a content product called Matrix Moments. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, you're recording this conversation and maybe like truncate it and use it for redistribution. Do you want to talk a little bit about Matrix Moments before we start to take questions?
Yes, actually, the person behind Matrix Moments is on this call. She's Saloni. She's our sort of she's behind the scenes, so to speak, with the title of this Clubhouse session. But she's really been instrumental in putting us on the sort of broader content map. So I'll tell you, what was the genesis of Matrix Moments, right? I think it was a conversation internally that we were having, saying, hey, we need to put ourselves out there. A lot of first-time entrepreneurs, a lot of repeat entrepreneurs, all of these guys are looking for, hey, if I'm taking money from you as a VC, what can I expect to learn from you? What can I expect through the journey? How will you help me? And, one is to say, hey, here are the five things I'll do from you, right? The second is you're actually trying to create even more broad-based impact, which is, hey, whether or not I'm in business with you, can I sort of distill learnings from our other portfolio companies and just put it out there? And obviously, it selfishly helps us because, when founders come to talk to us and when come to meet us, they already know what we stand for, right? They already kind of know, hey, here is how Tarun thinks about the world. Here is the way Avnish thinks about the world. Here is the way Vikram thinks about the world, Rajat, and so on and so forth, and the rest of the team, right? So, A, obviously, it selfishly serves a purpose where people get to know us better and know what we stand for. But it also really helps us constantly intellectually challenge ourselves by saying, okay, so this company worked. What did they do that worked? And can I apply that to my other companies? Or, hey, here's a mistake this company made. And can I distill it down to some learnings that I can share with the broader ecosystem? Right? And I think initially we started writing, and I had put out a few articles and a piece of that. And then honestly, we were just too lazy to write often. And we said, hey, why don't we try and do this as a conversation? And somehow that just found PMF within the firm where, we're always ready to get on a recording sessions like the one we're doing now or, the other ones that we've done. And we've broken it up into two or three different kinds of topics we talk about. One is just founder conversations, which I think generally end up getting the most traction, where there's a founder, it's from the horse's mouth. They're talking about their journey. They're talking about life in the trenches. They're talking about what's worked, what's not worked, stuff like that, right? The second is us as investors answering very tactical questions, right? Oh, how should co-founders decide split of equity? What are the key things I should look for when I'm signing my first term sheet? How do I handle a co-founder conflict, right? And again, with the benefit of having seen some of these situations play out in our companies, obviously, there is some advice we can offer, right? And it's unbelievable, but obviously a lot of this content exists for the US market, but there's very little that has been actually contextualized for the India market when it comes to these things, right? And so I think, or like, hey, I have two VCs that are talking to me. How do I decide? Like, should I take money from one VC or should I try and take money from both the VCs? Or, hey, I have a seed round coming together, but there's a VC that's also interested. Should I close my, seed round with some angels or should I, prioritize taking money from the VC? What if the VC doesn't sort of, sort of continue to double down in the next round? Is that a negative signal for my company? Right. And there's obviously, you know, founders have a lot of these questions. And I think we've taken sort of the opportunity to build this platform to actually just say, hey, here's how we think about it. We may be right, we may be wrong, but just putting yourself out there, and it's unbelievable, you know, how much feedback we get, both positive and negative, mostly positive, thankfully. But, you know, coming in over email, a lot of our episodes, you know, people play back to us. Avanish has done, I mean, probably he's done the most clearly. But, you know, he's got this recent episode on the hack job, which is around, you know, gamification and hacking growth. He's spoken about a bunch of other things. And a lot of founders we talk to say, hey, you know what, we learned so much in that 1 hour conversation. And so it's honestly, it's become a, you know, big, big source of just us being able to keep our founder in PSI.
And again, thank you, Tarun, for doing that shout out for Matrix Moments. One of my favorite, I know we were supposed to dive in, but we're way over time, is Avnish's one. There's a section about product versus distribution. I thought that was very fascinating.
Yes.
Again, these are simple, like you can just put it on and do your stuff, but it's so relevant to the founders, whether you're at the early stage, growth stage, or late stage. So many gems that are from folks who've been there, done that. So absolutely amazing. So do check for the folks in the room. Please do check it out if you have not done so already. Tarun, I pulled like 5 people up for questions. So the folks who are there, please make sure your questions are short, brief, and the ones that's not repetitive to what's been already talked about. And if you can keep it Twitter style, that would be great. So Abhishek, we'll start with you.
Thanks so much. Hi, Tarun. Thanks for taking my question. So can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, and my pleasure.
Okay, great. So yeah, I'll be quick. So I've been an ex-co-founder myself, and I've been in an Indian ecosystem. My company got acquired by Tribo Hotels actually in 2017.
Oh, lovely.
So I've had So I've had some first-hand experience talking to investors and VCs, and I did notice some trends back then, and I would just want some quick insights about that. So one thing I've noticed is that in the past decade or so, beyond a certain stage, many Indian startups have to seek funding from external investors, especially the large ones like SoftBank. And even some of our most successful companies like Ola or Paytm, you know, are in that category. So do you think there is or has been a lack of liquidity among Indian VCs? Or is it mostly because they were risk averse? Or is there any other reason that I'm missing here? And do you see that trend changing going forwards now that we have IPOs finally happening in the Indian startup ecosystem and more Indian VCs finally taking sponsoring the late stages of quality startups?
A good question, Abhishek. I think I don't see it necessarily as... So here's what's changed, right? If you told me 3 years ago, a company that needed $100 million, it was in some ways, you know, dependent on only the likes of a SoftBank, I would agree, or I would kind of agree. Today, I mean, if you just look at between Tiger Global, between Steadview, between Koto, between Quora, between Insight, I can name like 20 investors that one can go to raise 100 million. Now, admittedly, several of them are global investors, just because, like I said, we're still a fairly young ecosystem, right? But if I take a look closer home, like if you just see Westbridge, traditionally done, you know, later stage private equity and sort of public market investing, in the last 12 months, they've invested in two of our companies, right? One is DealShare, which was announced, and there's another one which will be announced very soon. They're writing 40, 50, you know, million checks, and they're happy to write 100 million plus checks in companies that are working. And so I think we will see a lot of sort of local growth capital that will also emerge. And going back to my earlier point around IPOs finally creating value, you will see large Indian family offices that today had real estate and, you know, public markets as an asset class that they would invest in. They will start moving a lot of their capital towards early stage ecosystem as well and private ecosystem as well. And so the reason why they weren't doing that today is many of them just didn't believe in like that these companies would actually emerge and become IPO scale and that they would get their sort of capital back. And so, and with handsome return. So I think going back to the earlier point of the IPO, I think it's important in more ways than one. And if you just look at like today, like take the likes of Edelweiss, IIFL, you know, Motilal Oswal, all of these guys are now setting up pre-IPO funds to invest in startups that are 12 to 18, maybe 24 months away from IPO. All of those funds can put 50 to 100 million to work now. So I think it's already changing.
Thank you, Abhishek, for the question. Divik?
Hi, thanks, Priya. Tarun, hi. My name is Divik, and my question was related to mobility, which is something that we didn't touch upon at all. When you look at the whole ecosystem of mobility, I mean, I'm presuming, I am talking about electric mobility alone. Which of the sectors of mobility excites you? What I'm trying to ask you is it the OEM, is it the battery manufacturer, or is it the services? That's the first question. And a follow-up to that is, do you think shared mobility in its present form factor is the right way that you foresee shared mobility being executed as days go by? Thanks, Aaron.
Great question, Divik, and thank you so much for that question. I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
That's
but,
right.
But I think, you know, starting with electric, we're still in, you know, forming our point of view because it's still very early days of, you know, if I look at mobility, we're basically still at, you know, day zero, right, when it comes to electric in the country. Now, we clearly believe in OEM because we've backed the hopefully what will be the largest electric OEM in the country, which is Ola Electric. They will also build all the battery technology in-house. So in some ways, you know, we've already kind of bet on the OEM and on the battery technology. Is there a services play? I think there will be a services play. If you look at sort of the likes of Vogo or Bounce or, you know, several other companies which are in that sort of sharing space, I think the economic models of those companies will only make sense when they move to electric fleet, right? And we've seen some version of that play out. And so I think we're investors in Vogo, and, you know, over time they will move the entire fleet to electric. So short answer is, I think there will be value created in all three. I don't think, you know, we have a view that, you know, there will be, you know, there's only one or the other that one needs to pick. And we kind of, you know, in some ways have exposure to all. On the form factor for mobility, I think, like I mentioned earlier, I don't know if you were there for that conversation. If you look at the current form factor, right, which is largely basically cars and maybe to some extent auto rickshaws, collectively these companies are doing about 5 million rides a day. If you just take top 10 cities, I think there's, you know, 500 million rides per day that are happening. I think there's an opportunity for somebody to come in and create another mobility company doing 10, 15, 20 million rides a day. The challenge is it's not going to be at the price point. It's not going to be at this 15, 20 rupees a kilometer. It's going to be in the 5 to 10 rupees a kilometer, which is the price point at which, you know, 90% of this country travels, right? Now, if somebody can basically create a product that can have sustainable unit economics at that price point, I think that's where the next 10 million rides per day company is going to come from. Our bet was, we made two bets in that space. One is Oi Rickshaw, which I spoke about, which is basically shared electric rickshaws serving the masses. And they operate at a 5 rupees per kilometer kind of price point broadly, right? Because it's shared and it's electric. And then there's Vogo, which was more of a personal mobility where it's, you know, bike sharing, so to speak. They're still figuring out the model, and still obviously because of the pandemic, things have been slow. But those were the two bets we made. And so absolutely agreed. I think all of these form factors will need to exist. And if you see the 5 to 10, 10 to 15, 15 to 20 rupees per kilometer price point, different form factors will need to emerge that will solve for different use cases. I don't think, you know, mobility in this country is done. There's a lot of, I mean, just you go walk out on the streets, and we all know how hard it is to commute in this country even today. And so I think there's a very long way to go.
Thank you, Tarun. Venkat?
Hi, Tarun. So I'm Venkat.
Hi,
so I have one question. Like, how do you see this EdTech, Tarun? Like, EdTech has become, is it going to become a saturation, or is it a bubble now? Because Matrix have been invested in companies like Testbook and Camp, K1 too, right? Like, so all these companies, yeah. Like, how do you see that? How do you see all these things? Like, what is the future focus of EdTech? Like, how do you define it? Because right now, like, we get personalized learning and all the options, right? Like, how Baiju's and Unacademy is going their way. So, I just want to know, like, because we a couple of we work with like games and everything, so I have like we have one virtual event startup as well, but we are just working on a couple of products in virtualizing the environment of game development, like gamification in EdTech fields actually. So I just want to know more about how it's going to be in the future, like what is the forecasting, like is it becoming saturated or what happens like when people, a lot of people come into this EdTech, right? Like, because there won't be, everything will be more of like privatization. I mean, like everyone will be getting to it. So I'm just asking one question, like, what is the future focus of it? Like, what the investors will be looking into a direct domain like that?
Yeah. So Venkat, as long as I guess people are getting educated, there will be a technology-led disruption of how they are getting educated. So I think continue to believe. Obviously, there are, you know, large and great companies like Byju's and Unacademy and Vedantu and a bunch of others that have sort of emerged. But again, if you just look at a percentage of overall education spend in this country, and you say, hey, how much of that is technology-led? What's your guess? Like, what percentage would be technology-led today? 1%, 2%, maybe, right? There is no reason if you look out 10 years that 10, 15, 20, maybe 30% of all education is going to be in some ways delivered over a technology platform, right? And part of it is because all of us are just now used to doing a, you know, bunch of things online. But part of it is just, you know, there is a personalization angle to it. There is, you know, multiple, you know, different, you know, cuts, doubt solving, and there's so many different kind of cuts that people are taking. So if you see education, you know, what fascinates me about the tech space in India, at least so far, right, is if I take a 2x2 matrix and I say, hey, large TAM and large profit pools, right? Education, maybe gaming, maybe some parts of fintech, right? These are basically the sectors that come to mind when one says very large, and maybe, you know, devotion, again, something hasn't emerged yet, but over time something will. But these are sort of large, very, very large markets in India, which are several hundred billion, where there are companies that are generating very healthy profit pools, right? If you take e-commerce, large TAM, but, you know, arguably, even some of the larger company, both offline and online, are still struggling to deliver large profit pools, right? And so I think EdTech is fascinating because it gives you that sort of potentiality of both scale and profit. Now, the worry over there is with so much capital coming in, do those profit pools vanish because there's just, it becomes just so expensive to acquire a customer. And some version of that, by the way, is playing in China, right? I don't know if you're aware, but China CAC for EdTech has just gone through the roof. It's almost impossible to build a company profitably there. So I think some version of that will play out in India as well. But I mean, keep that aside. Is there going to be, you know, multiple cuts within EdTech where there will be, you know, different kind of platforms that will emerge? Absolutely. Just the way, even though we have a Flipkart in e-commerce, there is a Nykaa and there is a, you know, Lenskart and there is a Meesho and there is DealShare and all these other companies. I think you will find multiple specialized versions of EdTechs, which are vertical EdTech platforms that will emerge.
Yeah, and Tarun, since I think Venkat mentioned CamKey12, which is a portfolio company of yours,
yes.
I can say from a personal reference standpoint, like my little one has been an avid user from, is a customer there, and he's learning Unity, C#,
yes,
by Unity. And it's just fascinating to see the quality of service that you get, right? And now
Correct. It's
all virtual. And I think the pandemic has also helped push those kind of comfort, as you said, with those experiences. Yes. So people are more...
No, and
so
you know, we my son, yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. No, sorry to interrupt. And you know, my son, like, he's generally very skeptical of all our investments. But the one that he personally uses is CamQ12.
Exactly.
And it's the one class I can tell you in the entire week, because all the kids today are just so fatigued of online education. But the one class I see him look forward to every week is CamQ12.
100. We do it twice a week and my son wants all 5 days. So we need to talk
exactly.
about it. But yeah.
Exactly.
But Bhavish, last question for you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Karun sir. Good morning to
you. Hi, Bhavish.
Hi, sir. So my question is around you. In this conversation, you said that China initially they supported all the tech companies, and now they are like snatching the support. Do you think that India it could happen with UPI? And like, do you think we need more alternatives to UPI in the fintech infrastructure?
I think one of the benefits of democracy, I think, is, like I said, things take time, but we are light years ahead, right? I mean, the world over, the payments ecosystem of India is actually now seen as an example that even the US is trying to emulate, right? I don't think any other country has built something like a UPI stack, which is completely democratized. No single entity owns it. And so to me, it's unclear. I don't know if I'm, you know, I understood your question correctly, but these are not things that, like, these are sort of entities that the government has set up to actually democratize this stuff and to prevent sort of large private companies, you know, owning, you know, this sort of stack. This stack is available for anyone to use at any time, and you know, there are sort of multiple stakeholders that the government keeps to sort of have the checks and balances in place. But in my mind, and similar versions of that, by the way, I don't know if you're aware, but similar to what the government did in payments, there is a e-health stack that is coming out, which talks about telemedicine and, you know, health records and, you know, a bunch of other stuff, and that will come out very soon. There's also an initiative to do this for mobility, right? Where is there a UPI-like stack for mobility where you can stitch together, if I want to go from point A to point B, every single mobility provider can basically tap into that system and acquire customers, right? And can serve customers from it. So I think this is, it's beautiful. Like that the fact that, you know, we are putting out these sort of open source architectures out there and allowing various private companies to build on top of it. I think that's the most scalable way to do it.
Hey, Tarun, thank you so much for this. I know we are squarely like 30 minutes over our scheduled time. So really appreciate you staying so long and taking all the questions and discussions. This was great. I'm sure we could keep going. Thank you so much for your time. Love to have you back again. I'm sure a bunch of the companies that you're in. I think the first time we met, like, you had just barely finished investing in Ola. And so, you know, can't wait to see companies like Ola go public in the coming weeks and months as well. And love to have you back as some of those things happen to talk about those journeys as well. Thank you so much, Tarun.
Thank you so much, Tarun,
for having me. No, my pleasure, Priya and Anand. Thank you so much for doing this. And I know it was delayed by a couple of months, but, you know, great to be finally doing this. And yes, Anand, fingers crossed. Hopefully, we'll see a lot more Olas, and hopefully we all will see Ola list soon as well. So, fingers crossed, and you know, it's a very exciting time to be part of this ecosystem.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Tarun. Thank you, Anand. Thanks all for joining us today.
And thank you, everyone, for joining in. Hopefully, this was a good use of everyone's time. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you, Tarun.
Thanks for tuning in. For more Matrix Moments episodes, you can head to www.matrixpartners.in/blog. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for more updates.